This podcast was recorded on Thursday, November 8th at 10:38 a.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear it.
Yeah, like those election night pledges of bipartisanship and cooperation will still be valid.
But there wouldn't be any snollygostering in that. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics, and all those snollygosters are shrewd politicians that we voted for or against in Tuesday's election. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Later in the podcast, Beck joins us to give us his take on the election. No, not that Beck. OSU political scientist Paul Beck.
I can promise you that that is the only time Paul Beck will be confused for a rock star. Forgive us for being a little punchy this week. We're just fresh off an election. As always, we'll use our GPS trackers to follow our outgoing governor. He was everywhere this week, if everywhere means several national TV shows. And he also dropped a big hint or a trial balloon about his future.
Yes, could be a trial balloon. But first,
I guess Ohio still is a Republican state.
Yes, Ohio remains red, a solid red. Republicans swept all the statewide executive offices this week, auditor, secretary of state, treasurer, attorney general, and the big prize, governor Mike DeWine, beating Democrat Richard Cordray by 182,000 votes, or 4 percentage points. After the hard-fought race, DeWine promised unity, and Cordray promised to keep fighting for his campaign issues.
But our challenges are not solvable just by one party. They're not solvable just by one person. They're solvable by all of us pulling together and working together, and that is my commitment to each and every one of you.
I believe that successful politics is not always defined by the outcome of an election. The reason we do this is because we want to improve people's lives. And I believe the work that all of you have done throughout this campaign has changed the conversation in ways that will dramatically improve the lives of people all over Ohio.
In the end, it was all about turnout, Republican turnout. 54% of registered Ohio voters cast ballots this week. Usually that means good news for Democrats, but not this year. Here's Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper, who says, don't blame the parties, get out the vote effort.
They hit the numbers. Rich Cordray hit the number over 2 million. No candidate has ever run for governor of Ohio as a Democrat and got 2 million and not been governor.
In fact, Richard Cordray got 116,000 more votes than John Kasich did when he was first elected governor in 2010, and 326,000 more votes than Bob Taft did in 1998. But Cordray fell short of what Ted Strickland, Ohio's last Democratic governor, got in 2006. And most importantly, he fell short of Mike DeWine.
Yes, he did. And it was surprising. I mean, the turnout was high. We thought that was good news for Richard Cordray. He was neck and neck in the polls, actually showed a bit of a lead before Election Day. But the Republicans turned out and voted for Mike DeWine and all the statewide executive candidates, even showed some surprising support for Jim Renacci in the Senate race. We'll get to that in a moment. But you have to give credit to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He got the rural Republicans. He kept the enthusiasm high among those folks, and they came out and they voted, and they voted for Mike DeWine. Richard Cordray got killed in the rural counties. That was the difference. He won the cities, which Democrats always do, but he did not get enough votes in the rural counties.
The best analogy I've heard all week is that Republicans have the real estate, Democrats have the numbers, but again, Republicans have the real estate, and this follows the arc that we've seen in recent weeks where Republican enthusiasm was creeping up and all this talk of a blue wave. Yeah, there might have been a blue wave in some parts of Ohio. Franklin County got a little more blue, but statewide, no. Democrats picked up 3 seats in the legislature, which is, I mean, it's minimal. Republicans still hold a supermajority there. it's a red state. It's not a purple state anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there was signs of a modest blue wave in other parts of the country. You know, you could argue Texas had a bit of a blue wave. I know Beto O'Rourke didn't win, but, you know, a few congressmen down there, Democrats, unseated Republicans, which was very surprising. Other parts of the country saw that the Democratic turnout fuel upsets. And of course,
we had two Muslim women elected to Congress.
Yeah, and, of course, Democrats won back the House. So you could say it was a wave. It wasn't a huge wave, but it was a wave, typical wave in a first midterm after a presidential election. But I think the bottom line is that Richard Cordray, while a very capable public servant, was not inspirational for Democrats. He didn't fire anybody up. So that was the first thing. He wasn't a Beto O'Rourke that fired up Democrats to go out and vote for him. Ted Strickland got 2.5 million votes when he won in 2006. His election was fueled by scandal at the State House and Democratic enthusiasm for a change. Richard Cordray, there was hints of scandal at the State House. He could have made more of an issue out of ECOT and the payday lending, pay-to-play scandal and the investigation that's involving former House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger. But he didn't make as much of a deal out of that. The bottom line is Ohioans are happy with the way things are going, and they stuck with the folks in charge.
And getting back to Ted Strickland was a pro-gun preacher. He did very well in rural counties. He is not Richard Cordray. Richard Cordray, if you ask my neighbors out in rural Union County, he's a Washington bureaucrat. That's, yep. And Ted, like I said, Ted Strickland was an NRA member. He was a preacher. He was a congressman. He was well-known in rural circles.
If you look at the maps in 2006, Ohio was mostly blue. It's a lighter blue, but all of those rural counties, you know, Ted Strickland won. And even in 2010, when he lost, a lot of the counties in his home congressional district in southeastern Ohio, along the Ohio River, the Athens area and east there, along the West Virginia border, were blue. There is no blue in Ohio right now except for the cities. And it's all red, and the red is a deep red most
of those
counties. And
the blue map that you're talking about in 2010, that is during the Tea Party wave following a recession.
Yeah.
That is not what's happening right now. We have a great economy led that the president is taking credit for, that the Ohio legislature is taking credit for. It's honestly kind of surprising when you back up now that Cordray did as well as he did.
Yeah, now of course the second guessing begins.
Right.
Should Betty Sutton have been at the top of the ticket? Would a female candidate have done better statewide in this quote year of the woman than Richard Cordray? I don't know. Hindsight's always 20/20. Should he have taken the ECOT scandal by the horns and really made a huge deal out of that? I don't know. Should he have countered the rape kit argument that Mike DeWine made very effectively early on in the campaign? Who knows? It's a lot of second guessing when you lose a relatively close election. But I just think the bottom line is that most Ohioans think that the state is on the right track.
Mm-hmm.
Why change horses when you're riding along fine?
Joining us now for more on this week's election is longtime Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck. Paul, welcome back to Snollygoster.
Good to be with you.
What's your biggest takeaway?
Well, there's several takeaways. One was we heard a lot about a Democratic wave, a blue wave in this election. And there was, I think, a blue wave. It wasn't as large as the Democrats had hoped for or that the Republicans had feared. But it certainly has moved the Democrats into a majority position in the House of Representatives. So we now have divided government. And going forward, I think divided government's really going to matter for the next 2 years of the Trump administration and for the country as well. The other takeaway is astoundingly high levels of turnout in a midterm election. They go up by double digits in Ohio compared to a low base, which was 2014. But still, if more than half of Ohioans who were registered to vote voted in this election, and that's a remarkable level, and I think it's going to hold across the country once we are able to take a careful look at that.
To that end, Paul, Richard Cordray got nearly 200,000 more votes than Ted Strickland did in 2010, and he still lost. Why did the blue wave not hit Ohio?
Well, I think it probably did, but it wasn't enough. Maybe a red wave hit here as well. There was higher turnout on the Republican side, obviously. So I think that you know, this was a high-energy election. And, of course, it's a high-energy election in a divided country and a divided Ohio and a deeply partisan polarized electorate. So people were whipped up on both sides of the aisle, and I think that's what led to the higher turnout.
So yeah, the conventional wisdom is higher turnout helps Democrats. That wasn't the case here in Ohio. It helped both parties pretty equally.
I think that's right. Yes, yes. And of course, Trump and Pence were here a lot. And I think what they did was they made sure that many of these people who had voted Republican back in 2016 didn't sit this one out, as they might have been inclined to do. And so that really, I think, affected the results.
Mike and I were talking this morning about the DeWine campaign, how they did a good job focusing on rape kits in the first half of the campaign. Then they really hit home with the economy down the home stretch. Is there one campaign in particular that you were impressed with, or one that you thought really underwhelmed maybe?
Well, the impressive one was Sherrod Brown going against all the other campaign or all the other results in the state. He's somebody who I think was very vulnerable as you looked at that race 2 years ago, and it didn't turn out to be that he was all that vulnerable. He really, I think, ran a good campaign. He had a weak opponent. Renacci, for a lot of reasons, didn't turn out to be a very strong opponent. I think Republicans thought he would be. But it just didn't turn out that way.
The Republicans kind of kicking themselves because, Sherrod Brown won by 6 points, which is a comfortable margin.
Yes.
But he was up by double digits in the polls. Renacci was a lesser-known candidate. He was a congressman, but he wasn't known statewide. He didn't spend a dime on this campaign.
That's right.
He didn't run an ad from June until October. The state Republican Party came in with those Me Too ads against Sherrod Brown. Are there any regrets that Republicans did not find a different candidate or didn't invest more in Jim Renacci? Could he have made this race closer? Could he have won? Or could another candidate have beaten Sherrod Brown?
Well, the question is, what would Josh Mandel have done against Sherrod Brown? And I think that Sherrod Brown is, in many ways, a very good fit for the Ohio electorate. He has done what a lot of Democrats in Ohio haven't been able to do very effectively, at least not statewide, and that is appeal to white working class males. And I think that he is seen as genuine, not a politician per se. He has kind of a disheveled look, and maybe that helps. I don't think it's intentional necessarily. I think that's Sherrod Brown. But I've also seen him at rallies that were union rallies where he really is able to strike a good pose with them and come across, I think, as somebody who listens to them.
Some evidence of that in Northeast Ohio, where Donald Trump did surprisingly well 2 years ago. Ashtabula County, Trump won it by 19 points 2 years ago. Brown won it by 2 points this year. Trump won Trumbull County 2 years ago. Brown won it easily this year. Portage County, Trump won it by 10. Brown won it by 6. Mahoning County, Hillary won it 2 years ago, but only
barely.
By 3 points. Brown wins at this time 60-40.
Well, and what I heard, and you guys may be able to confirm this, is that the Democrats lost a state legislative seat in Mahoning County.
They did, outside of Youngstown.
Yeah, and so, okay, Brown does really well there, but a Democrat running for the state legislature doesn't do nearly as well, and actually that seat gets lost.
It could be the message. I don't know what that candidate ran on.
I don't either.
But Brown had, you're right, Brown does have that good message, working class attractiveness,
and again,
anti-trade, frankly.
Yeah, and he's somebody that you would think, he's very liberal. On a whole host of issues, the exception maybe being trade.
Yep.
Very liberal and is not at all bashful about saying that. And yet, in a state that is fairly conservative and trending more Republican, he is still able to win re-election.
Paul, we're an Ohio podcast, Ohio politics podcast, but all elections are nationalized now. This is the first time that some Democrats like Joyce Beatty will have ever been in the majority. What do you think that their play is? What do you think the smart tactic is? Is it obstructionism, or is it bipartisanship? What would you advise these newly empowered Democrats to do?
Well, what I would advise are two things. One is to try to find pieces of legislation that might have a bipartisan appeal. One of them may have to do with health care and protection of pre-existing conditions, not just to say we're going to protect pre-existing conditions, but to make sure that insurance companies can't charge more to people who have pre-existing conditions. So if they put that on the table, that would be a tough issue for Republicans in the House and in the Senate, if it were to pass the House, to deal with. Another one is infrastructure. And that's something the Trump administration has talked about. They pushed a proposal early on that really wasn't a very meaningful proposal. It will take more revenue on the table from the federal government. And so that, again, is going to be a real test issue with the Republican opposition in the House. And then secondly, they have responsibilities for oversight. they need to be very careful how they do the oversight, not to do it across the board, but to pick their places where there seem to be really egregious examples of either ethics violations or, in the case of the Mueller investigation, collusion or complicity between the Trump campaign and the Russians in 2016. But they need to do that very carefully. They don't want to emerge as just attacking the Trump administration on every ground.
Paul Beck, longtime Ohio State University political scientist. Thanks again for joining Snollyguster.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
The 2018 midterm election is over. That means people are racing to New Hampshire and Iowa to get ready for 2020. And one person who's getting a little more name recognition, whose name we're seeing floated out there a lot, the man we just spent several minutes talking about with Paul, Sherrod Brown.
Yeah, you know, his margin of victory wasn't what we expected. It was a little closer than we expected, but given the turnout on the Republican side, perhaps not that surprising. But yeah, a lot of national columnists are now putting his name in the mix. You know, we've heard a lot about Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, but now Sherrod Brown is being added to that list pretty regularly. Also being added to that list is Beto O'Rourke, even though he lost in Texas. And Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, is also being mentioned also as a possible 2020 candidate. So, yeah, he's going to be talked about in the next year or so until he says he's not running or until he decides to run.
I have no idea if he wants to run. In the past, he's always kind of dodged the question, which is the politically smart thing to do. He never wants to put himself
I have no plans to run.
Right, right. Also what Elizabeth Warren has told Steve Inskeep a couple times now. I'd be a little surprised if he runs, honestly. I have no idea. I'm this is out of nowhere. I've never talked to the man about it. I wonder if he does have aspirations, and I don't. Paul talked a little bit about his kind of disheveled manner. When I look at Sherrod Brown, it doesn't scream presidential to me. I mean, that's just off the top of my head talking about it. That's just my thought.
The bottom line is for Democrats who are going to challenge a sitting president is, do I think I can win? That's the bottom line decision maker. Do I think I can win? If it's yes, then you run. And then I think that for the party is, they do need a populist to counter Donald Trump. And Sherrod Brown is a populist. He appeals to that white working class voter. We saw it in the results from this week's election. He can get those Trump voters. So, you know, I think he might be a better vice presidential candidate to help Democrats restore the blue wall in the Midwestern industrial states, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. Can he lead the ticket? I don't know. I mean, but he'll be talked about a lot in the next several months.
We will also have a Republican governor at that time. So Sherrod Brown should become president. That would leave a vacancy in the Senate. And Mike DeWine would get to appoint his replacement. I don't know if they get that far down the road, but it would seem that would be one check in the con column, I think.
Democrats would take that deal, though.
Would take that deal. I have large suspicions about whether he could beat Elizabeth Warren in a primary at this point. I don't know if Bernie Sanders is he'll be pushing 80 at that point, I think. I don't know if he's the guy you want to trot out there. I would think Elizabeth Warren would be the leader in the clubhouse at this point.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out.
It's going to start before long.
Oh, it has started. We saw them in town last week of the campaign.
Yeah, I mean, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have both been in town recently.
Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, all in town campaigning for Sherrod Brown and Richard Cordray. So it has started.
I guess you're right. It has started. Speaking of 2020, it's time now for our weekly bit of speculation as we track the movements of our outgoing governor. That means it's time for John Kasich GPS.
Governor Kasich, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thanks, Chuck. So,
Governor, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
We went to Tulsa instead of where we were going in Colorado.
I think I've eaten my way across the entire state of New York.
Ground control.
With the election behind us, John Kasich is really on a mission to stay relevant. And on Election Day, he was all over national TV.
Please welcome back Governor John Kasich.
John Kasich.
Joining our conversation now, Ohio Governor John Kasich. Are you a never-Trumper?
I couldn't. No, I'm not a never-anybody.
You know, I think we can call John Kasich a never-Trumper, Steve. What'd you think?
If he's not a never-Trumper, who is?
That's right. So that was John Kasich on The View, The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and with MSNBC's Nicole Wallace. His interview on The View was perhaps the most interesting. Take this exchange with Whoopi Goldberg.
Are you running for president?
I don't know.
I mean, all my options are on the table. You know, in the Republican Party, pretty hard because it's kind of locked down right now, but we don't know what's going to come in the future. But I think for the first time, there is a legitimate chance for a third party candidate who's, you know, because if you have the Republicans on the extreme and the Democrats on the extreme, there's a big wide open space in the middle. So all of my options are on the table, Whoopi, and I just want to contribute.
It's happening, Mike. Can you feel it? Can you feel the momentum building?
Well, that's the strongest. He still is very noncommittal, but that's the strongest hint, a.k.a. trial balloon, that he would be an independent candidate for president in 2020. In the past, he's sort of brushed off, saying it's hard to do. I'm just waiting around to see what happens. But that's a definite stake in the ground that he is seriously considering an independent bid for president.
It's good news copy. It's good for political podcasters. But there is no road to the White House for an independent right now. I mean, how's he getting?
3 years ago, was there a road for Donald Trump to the White House?
But he's not an independent. He won the Republican nomination.
I know.
And John Kasich is in that cut very specifically talking about an independent. And
the hardest thing for an independent candidate is you do not have the party structure behind you.
Right.
That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
You have to get on the ballot in all 50 states, and it's hard to do, and it requires a lot of money. But we are really in odd times. I mean, you saw it just yesterday, that news conference that Donald Trump held, the way he was just – I mean – it was WWE, World Wrestling Federation stuff, the way he was fighting with the media. Then 2 hours later, he fires Jeff Sessions and hires this critic of the Mueller investigation to be his acting attorney general. There's a lot that's going to happen in the next 2 years, and I would not rule anything out.
Yeah, he doesn't have a road to the White House as an independent. I will come on and say that. I would say he could be near the front of the line if a second term for Trump is ruled out for one reason or another.
Yeah. That's one of the options for a lot of Republicans. Mm-hmm. I think John Kasich being probably the leading one right now, that he's waiting in the wings if Trump falters or does not run for re-election. I think him giving a strong chance for an independent bid is, it's not likely, but it's not as completely out of the question as it would have been maybe a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Paul Beck would say about this? We should have asked Beck.
I don't know.
Not that Beck. Paul Beck.
He'd say the same thing you did. It's hard. It's nearly impossible to run an independent bid. We've had good efforts in the past. John Anderson back in the 1980s. Ross Perot in 1992. And Ross Perot was probably the strongest choice. He got 18% of the vote.
A billionaire, I think, or at least a 100 millionaire.
That's why I think John Kasich is floating this out. I think he's trying to see if there's any money out there to support an independent bid. Folks like Michael Bloomberg or
Elon Musk or like some startup company.
Yeah, he's looking to see if there is money out there for an independent bid. That's what a trial balloon is. You float it out there, see if it gains any traction. I don't blame him there.
I'd cover it. It'd be great. I would love for it to happen. All right, well, we will leave you with some Beck on this week's episode.
Paul Beck?
Yes, Paul Beck, whatever. What's the musician Beck's first name? His first name? I have no idea.
He's like Sting.
We are losing any street cred we had right now. Beck Hansen.
It's his first name.
Our engineer just told us, Eric French told us, Beck Hansen. You learn something every day. Anyway, Beck Hansen. Thanks, Beck Hansen. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. Be sure to listen next week. And be sure to subscribe. Tell your friends about us. Leave us good reviews on iTunes. Shoot us an email as well, snollygoster@wosu.org. Until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster on WOSU Public Media. Pistols are pointing at a poor man's pockets, smiling eyes ripping out of his sockets. Got a devil's haircut in my mind.